This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning and this is The Breakfast Grill. A prosperous, inclusive and sustainable Malaysia, a goal that most citizens would want. But is the 12 Malaysia Plan the roadmap that will help us achieve this? Or would it be 530 pages of well-crafted words with hollow promises that don't achieve their outcomes, let down by poor execution and policy coordination? Answering these questions and more this morning is Dato' Sri Mustafa Mohamad, the Economics Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill, Dato' Sri, and thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. I'm sure you've been very busy. Now, I want to start with a press release that was released last evening, I think on the Bumi equity issue. So it was partially because during the Prime Minister's 12 MP speech in Parliament, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri said that the sale of Bumiputra shares or companies will only be offered and sold to fellow Bumiputra consortiums, firms and individuals under a soon-to-be-introduced government measure, supposedly to ensure sustained Bumiputra equity ownership. But can you clarify this for us, please? What is the situation now?
The objective of the statement yesterday was to clarify what was stated by the Prime Minister in the speech made last Monday. I think there's an impression that every company has got to offer shares to Bumiputra. So what we said yesterday was that this relates only to disposal of shares by Bumi institutions. There are three types of Bumi. One is individual Bumis. Number two, what we call Bumi institutions. Number three, institutions with a Bumi mandate. So we're developing a framework whereby disposal shares by Bumi institutions and Bumi mandated institutions, they are required in the first instance to offer those shares to Bumiputra. The objective is to make sure that there's no erosion of what is already in Bumi hands. That's the purpose. Of course, the mechanics are still a work in progress. The objective yesterday was to clarify them. Hopefully, I hope out there people are, clearer of what the government's intention is.
But let me clarify this also, that it then means that the government's target of maintaining or boosting Bumiputra corporate equity ownership remains at 30%. There's no change to this overarching policy, right?
The policy is there, but of course it's going to be now 2030. We have some way to go. 2019 was 17.2%. The reason why is 2019, because the pandemic, SSM, the company's commission submissions were delayed because of the COVID-19. That's the reason why we should have got 2020 numbers, but it's delayed because of this delay in submission of annual returns by companies to the company's commission.
Okay, there's two issues I have with this, Dato' Sri. One of which is the actual way the data is presented, right? So you say 17.2% is in the hands of Bumi or Bumi companies. But there's a large percentage, and that's 12.3% held by nominees. So there's always been question marks as to who these nominees are, and perhaps there are Bumis in there. The second thing I have is, if you restrict it in just in terms of the corporations or let's say GLICs, doesn't the pool of investors actually then become very small?
On the second part, yes, it's quite true. It's creating some concerns among Bumi institutions. I've been talking to them. I'll continue to talk to them to see how we can take into account some of their concerns. On the nominees, indeed, is an issue. The 12% is a big number.
Yes.
The current law, there's nothing to prevent nominees. We need to get to the bottom and find out who the final beneficiaries of those shares are. And going forward, there are proposals that there's got to be amendments to some laws to ensure that those nominees declare who the beneficial owner is. What we've done, in terms of technical details, the number is actually more than 12%. So what we've done, to extend that we're able to dig up the files and get to the bottom, we've been able to reduce. 12%, is actually in the beginning it was a lot bigger than that.
Okay.
So we've been able to reduce it. But going forward, I think we are committed to ensure that there's more transparency, but that requires changes in rules, regulations and laws as well.
All right. Now, the other thing is, why is equity ownership still a measurement of wealth? I mean, and a just and, you know, measurement of wealth and a driver of this just and more equitable social economic development, which we are so, of course, I think it's still very important for Malaysia. Is there a better measurement? Because this equity 30% threshold has been around since 1971.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's a very dynamic. The world has changed a lot. There are calls, you know, coming from many directions that we should revisit the way we look at wealth. But equity ownership remains relevant. Yeah. I mean, having said that, we have to continue looking at several other measures as well. For example, property ownership. We have attempted with that, and we actually have some numbers. But it's equally challenging for being patronized in that segment as well. Property ownership, land, of course, is one. Houses is another. Mm-hmm. Commercial properties. We actually have some numbers, so that's another measure. But going to all those measures, the position has been the same, that we need to do a lot more to ensure that Bumis have, you know, a bigger stake in the economy. But, of course, we acknowledge the fact that, you know, it's got to be on the basis of a growing cake. Mm. It's not going to be expense of other Malaysian communities or foreigners. We have this policy of 100% foreign ownership in manufacturing, which has been in place for a few decades now. And as we said in a few of our narratives, this 100% equity ownership manufacturing is almost a given now. That's why foreign ownership is about 45%. The biggest chunk in terms of share ownership actually is owned by foreigners. And commercial land, for example, when it comes to buildings, if I am a foreign investor, I can buy land as well besides leasing. So that's another dimension. So this is an equally important thing that we have to look at.
Okay, I want to put this into context though, Dato' Sri. You're the MP for Jeli, which is in Kelantan, right? I mean, in 2018, there were 47,000 registered voters, most involved in agriculture. So I want to know, how does a 30% Bumi equity threshold help them unless they perhaps invest in Amanah Saham or have deposits in Tabung Haji? Should we then move actually more towards a needs-based way of addressing the inequality and help all B40s, like what the Prime Minister said last evening?
Well, my constituents are mainly farmers, majority of more than half. They are mainly rubber tappers. Some of them have savings in Tabung Haji and also in PNB. When it comes to enhancing Bumi participation in the economy, it's got to be a holistic approach. It's not just shares. Mm. Shares, of course, Kampung folks, people who live in my area, they're not involved in share trading. They don't own any shares unless indirectly in the Bursa Malaysia, for example. It is true. These are poor people in B40. So when it comes to increasing Bumi participation, increasing the incomes of Bumi Putera, it's got to be a holistic approach.
Not just favoring just a few, right?
Not just shares. I mean, of course, it's not very relevant to them. Yeah, indirectly it is. Yeah, so we got to loans, for example, you know, facilities, entrepreneurship, which are training, education is key to it. We believe, as we all know, education is a game changer. So what we need to do more of that, yeah, getting more poor Malaysians to be 14 to be better educated. And by doing that, they are in a position to move up in the social ladder. They can be involved in higher paying occupations. And that's one way of getting Malays to own more shares and play an active role in the Malaysian economy.
Okay, I want to go back to this theme of this new government. Keluarga Malaysia runs through this rather impressive plan, but we also have some very ambitious target embedded in the 12th Malaysia plan, including a development expenditure of 400 billion ringgit. But I understand that some of it is going to the rehabilitation of government-linked companies or statutory bodies like Tabung Haji and Felda. And that's a departure from previous Malaysia plans. Can you help us break it down? How much is actually really going to actual development expenditure, and how much of it is going to, some would say, bailouts?
The 11th plan, we allocated 260 billion ringgit. 248 billion was spent during 11th plan, spanning period 2016-2020. We have a portion of that, of this rehab in the 11th plan, in the 12th plan, and there's a bit more. More than half of the 400 billion in DE development expenditure goes to what we call basic development. Construction of buildings, roads, that's what we call basic development. The conventional infrastructure and social infrastructure, economic infrastructure. So more than half goes there. This time around, we have the likes of course, Wan DB, Tabung Haji. There's a bit of that, yeah?
Yes.
In the development expenditure. And these are commitments. And the other will be the public-private finance initiatives. Projects have been implemented under the PFI approach, which has been, you know, for more than 10 years we've been doing that. That involves payments, annual commitments. So that's another portion of the 400 billion that we have announced in the 12th National Plan. More than half is what we call basic development. So you're right in a way, yeah. Although in the 11th plan there was a bit of that, but there's a bit more in the 12th plan.
So the headline figure in terms of development might not be that large. But I'm curious, are you expecting any bombshells from these government-linked companies or statutory bodies? Because I was under the impression that these issues with regards to Tabung Haji Felda have been resolved.
We cannot resolve over 1 year. Both in the case of Tabung Haji and Felda, is over a period of 10 years. Resolved meaning that there was a solution in the case of Tabung Haji in the form of Sukuk, Felda as well, but it's going to take 10 years altogether. It's a big amount. Therefore, it's got to be...
But there will be no more surprises in terms of losses?
The Ministry of Finance is fairly transparent on this. They have a list of what they call guarantees, committed projects, 20 altogether, and that's available in the public domain, and the public has got access to this information. Of course, in this age, day and age,
there are no secrets, Dato Sri.
We have got to be as transparent as possible, and then that's the spirit in Parliament now. There has been a lot of proposals that we should be more aggressive in the area of transparency, and we acknowledge the need for us to be more and more transparent going forward.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning is Dato Sri Mustafa Mohamed, Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. When we come back, shouldn't the private sector lead economic growth? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back. In the hot seat this morning is Dato Sri Mustafa Mohamed, Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. Before the break, clarity on the Bumi equity ownership issue, and isn't a needs-based approach the best way to address inequality? Now, Dato Sri, many impressive targets, they appear ambitious, include average GDP growth of 4.5 to 5.5 per annum from 2021 to 2025. We're pretty much done with 2021, and even the World Bank has cut our GDP growth to 3.3% for this year. So I'm just curious, isn't this range of 4.5 to 5.5 a rather tall order, considering that even before the 4 years prior to this plan, it was only averaging 2.7%, and many sectors will still take time to recover, like tourism and even our SMEs. So what are the growth assumptions based on, and what will drive it?
Tall order, partly because of the pandemic. We have been adversely affected by the pandemic, contraction of 5.6%, which was unprecedented last year. So a tall order, in my view, in the context of very difficult times Malaysians are going through now. But next year, as we all know, there's going to be economic recovery throughout the world. And Malaysia, being an open economy, is going to reap the benefits of this global economic recovery. The Ministry of Finance is tabling the budget 2022 on the 29th of October, and the numbers or forecast for next year will be out officially.
So you're confident that we can achieve
these
figures?
Yes, because 4.5 to 5. In fact, there are people who think that's quite conservative. We know that as our economy matures, it will become increasingly difficult to get to 9-10%. Mind you, from 1987 to about 96, we were about 10% growth per annum, which is the kind of growth that China went through for many years. That was in the early stages of economic growth. So, of course, in theory and, of course, based on experience of many countries, as we mature, we cannot, it's impossible to go to the 9-10%. 10%. But we believe it's realistic. And manufacturing, for example, the first half of this year, more than 15% double-digit growth, which is a good performance. Of course, that was, you know, this performance was against a low base the first half of last year. But we begin to see improvements all around agriculture, oil and gas, with the recovery in oil prices. Services, which is the biggest chunk, more than 55% of our economy is services. And you're right, service sector has been badly affected. Tourism, yes. Aviation, for example. Aviation will take some time to recover, tourism as well. But there are other elements of services. The wholesale and retail, for example, the evidence of big restaurant business is coming back, not coming back to life yet, but slowly recovering. Yeah.
But Dr. Sri, COVID-19 is a very humbling pandemic, right? It will, you know, you never know. You think you've got everything under control, and before you know it, cases flare up. So isn't our assumptions expecting growth recovery to be linear? I mean, have we factored in the possibility of perhaps COVID-19 cases rising again, and then there's another lockdown, and then in turn we can't achieve these figures?
Well, the world is so uncertain. That was true in the 11th plan. Nobody expected the pandemic to come. You know, 2020 was a very bad year. It's a very dynamic, volatile world. Now you have this energy crisis in the UK, in China, for example. So, of course, we acknowledge the fact that, you know, it's difficult to predict, you know, accurately what's going to happen. But 4.5 to 5.5 growth, we believe, is modest and is reasonable, and it is achievable.
Okay, there's also a commitment to lower the fiscal deficit to 3.5% by 2025. How will this be achieved? Because tightening the belt is not a habit of governments. Some point to our annual bill for minister salaries and perks. But seriously, how important is it to institutionalize fiscal responsibility? I mean, we just have to look at the recent Auditor General report and feel this sense of despair. Is there, you know, are we going to improve in this front?
The Prime Minister chaired the Fiscal Committee. We meet 3-4 times a year. Last week, there was a meeting of this committee, and we reviewed the whole scenario. I mean, there are many components in this deficit. Deficit GDP ratio, of course, the denominator will be GDP. Mm. Numerator will be deficit, and there are many other factors as well. Firstly, it is important to have a long term sustainability. So the 3.5% target is reasonable. Granted, we know that demands coming from the public is, you know, expectations are very high. Because we have revenue and we have expenditure. On the expenditure part, we know that operating expenditure, big chunk into salaries, emoluments and pension, so nothing much we can do there. Development expenditure, we would like to push as much as we can. The other will be the revenue. We've been actively looking at additional revenue sources. In recent months, we've been depending quite a bit on government companies, like Petronas and others. But the short-term measure and going forward, we've been exploring. Ministry of Finance has been studying various possibilities of how we can widen the revenue base. Looking at our peers in the region.
Are you going to then reform our taxation system, make it broader perhaps, because our contribution tax to GDP is rather low? Before the crisis was about 12% only.
Yes, compared to our peers in the region, we are one of the lowest in the world, and something's got to be done. We have civil servants, we have, of course, hospitals, we have schools, we have the armed forces, the police. I mean, these are, you know, essential expenditure for the government to provide the best services. Therefore, public demands are increasing, and over and above that, you got demands for increased development, like covering potholes on the roads, school repairs. So going forward, the public's been more and more demanding. So we got to be realistic. If you want better services, of course, there's no choice but to widen your revenue base and make your tax collection machinery more efficient. So these are some of the things that the Ministry of Finance is looking at, and I believe in the budget some of these issues will be addressed.
Now, what do you say to those who argue that there are no new ideas in the 12th Malaysian Plan, and actually this was an opportunity for a great reset for the Malaysian economy that, you know, was heading towards this middle income trap that we have all heard and discussed? The four enablers and 14 game changers that are embedded in the 12th Malaysian plan before. What's new about this plan?
Well, the three themes in the plan. The first one is resetting the economy. This has provided an opportunity, and we believe we've not missed this opportunity either. And a number of reforms are going to be put in place. We have 14 game changers, so we're going to transform. You know, for example, looking at investments, which play a very important role in the development of the Malaysian economy, not just foreign, local as well. We got to provide a better ecosystem, ease of doing business, the gig economy. Which is expanding, the sharing economy is expanding rapidly, and we have to prepare for this new reality. So there's got the reforms in terms of social protection. There's been a lot of talk about Malaysians not being adequately covered by social protection schemes, EPF and SOCSO, for example. So there's got to be reforms on this. Education, we continue to have problems, mismatch between demand and supply. We've decided a couple of weeks ago that there should be a single platform where we put everything together, the demand side and the supply side, the supply coming from the various Tibet institutions, demand side coming from companies. It appears very simple, but because the government is huge and there is no coordination.
Yes.
So this is some of the reforms which you got to put in place. Getting people to work together, you know, the whole of society approach. I mean, it's just said and done.
Yeah.
It's got to be done if you want to move forward and reform the Malaysian economy. It's got to be done. Otherwise, we'll be losing out in terms of competition to our regional peers.
Okay, because when I look at the document, it's, you know, I don't think anyone will say that the objectives are not good for the country. But it does seem like that lacks a certain granular detail in terms of how we're going to achieve our targets. For example, even things like our GNI per capita of 57,000. How are we going to get there by 2025? Would it have been better to be less ambitious and lay out less grand plans but be more detailed in terms of achievements?
There is this misunderstanding. The plan is a plan. It's a broad overall plan. We have ministries.
Mm.
We're not going to go granular to tell the Ministry of Education itself what to do. That's their
job. So they are going to do it.
Yes, of course. So,
but who's going to direct it, though?
Oh, that's going to be the Prime Minister will chair an implementation council. We are now working on an implementation plan. So the plan sets out the broad agenda. The granular details will be come up from various ministries. And some are there. The Tibet is there.
Mm.
We know what higher education is doing, what human resources are doing. Of course, health ministry. As I said, with this implementation council chaired by the PM, we hope to be able to resolve some of the implementation issues.
Yeah. Because, as usual, there's so many ministries involved for every single game changer,
yeah,
right?
It's a problem. We've been working in silos, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. How are we going to prevent this working in silos? Who's going to play referee, Dr. Sri? Who's going to coordinate everything?
Yeah. Prime Minister said it in very clear terms that he's going to chair this implementation council, and secretary will be the economic planning unit. Of course, the chief secretary of the government will have to play a very important role. A lot depends on civil servants. We have to make sure that the whole civil service bucks up and, you know, make sure that we work as a team. Yeah, there's a tendency. I mean, you name it. You talk about Tibet. There's so many institutions.
Yes.
Coming under so many different ministries, and we've been having this problem of getting people working together closely on Tibet. So we hope that's going to be history. Yeah, when it comes to Tibet coordination, we hope it's going to put behind us. And moving forward, we've got this single platform which has already been decided, yeah, so that we know who's doing what, who's producing what. We're going to avoid duplication. And as Prime Minister said, some courses probably are not relevant anymore. We know that in some places, they have closed some departments, yeah, which is a normal thing to do. We've got to move new things, yeah. Online and digital, those are the new artificial intelligence, those are the new things that we have to, you know, going forward, we've got to do more of those things.
Today's guest on the special extended breakfast grill is Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato' Sri Mustafa Mohamed. When we come back from the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin, the importance of the public sector and what are these institutional reforms we can expect? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to a special extended breakfast grill where this morning in the hot seat is Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Dato' Sri Mustafa Mohamed. We were asking about the policy inconsistencies and whether the 12th Malaysian Plan is just too ambitious. Now, Dato' Sri, you mentioned this you know, governments working in silos. And I'm just curious whether it also then means that there is sometimes policy inconsistencies, even within the government. And I give you an example of this, because we are really trying to push ahead in terms of attracting foreign direct investment and also even just domestic investment. But if we look at a good example, it's the current cabotage policy, which does not allow any exemptions for foreign vessels to repair underwater cables. Industry experts say that, you know, this could be one of the reasons why Malaysia is not part of the Apricot project with Google and Facebook. So I understand 7 ministries are involved. Decision has been delayed, with one ministry very vocal over their objections. But who decides what is best for the country, especially with this 12 Malaysian plan target for the digital economy to be 25% of GDP?
We're not perfect, of course. What's important is that we've been listening a lot to the ground, and we've set up a portal in APU to receive feedback from the public in terms of implementation. Digital is a big theme in the 12th plan going forward. Not only MSMEs, micro, small, medium enterprise, but also government. We are pleased to note that there's been a bigger take-up rate in terms of digitalization. This is a very important agenda, one of the game changers in the 12th Malaysia plan. In terms of policy inconsistencies, yes, sometimes there is this issue. We have to find a way how to manage. We have various councils. We have the Economic Council, we have the Employment Council, the Digital Economy Council, the Digital Council, for example. EPU, the secretariat, with 6 clusters. This is where we coordinate. We have a cluster on infrastructure, on talent development, on government, as examples, on science and technology. So that's how we manage things in government. In the event there are issues, cabinet, of course, is the ultimate arbitrator of these issues. Certainly, we've got to do a better job. Sometimes there are issues, but we've done well overall. But sometimes we have hiccups, which is, I'm not saying it's normal, but we're not perfect. But what's important is we listen and we do make adjustments to policies and implementation problems after having listened to the ground.
Now, globally, governments, of course, are using fiscal tools to engineer an economic recovery. But since the 12 Malaysia plan is a medium-term one, ideally, shouldn't the private sector be taking the lead in these, 8 sectors that the government wants to prioritise? Is it the business of governments to be in business, Dato' Sri?
The private sector has played a very important role in Malaysia's economic development, not only foreign investments, but we have a number of large domestic conglomerates which have been doing a lot to develop the Malaysian economy. We also have the GLCs. The issue is, what more we can do to accelerate the growth of private investment. This is an issue, the role of government in the Malaysian economy. In general, it is our policy to consolidate the government's role in the Malaysian economy. We want private investments to play a bigger role. That has got to do with domestic investments and foreign investments. So going forward, it is important to ensure that rules and regulations are made simple, as nimble as possible. This is becoming more important because we are talking about regional competition, never mind global competition. We have our regional peers.
Yes.
Where things
it's
are...
It's a race for FDI.
Yes, a race for FDI. We are conscious of that, and we have this concept called National Investment Aspiration, which has been introduced last year. So it is important to make sure that we create an ecosystem that's conducive for private investment, and we meet the private investment often. We've set up what we call Pemuda. Secretary is in MPC, and I have been asked to chair this meeting, this particular platform. So going forward, we have to do a lot more to encourage private investment. The pandemic has, of course, resulted in some pushbacks. But
yes.
going forward in the next 10 years to achieve the shared prosperity vision, which is development for all, reducing gaps, and also achieving united prosperous Malaysia.
So
we have to be a high income nation. Yeah. Therefore, private investment will have to play a very important role going forward.
And I suppose part of this will be then seeing a gradual removal of any, left protectionist schemes that we currently have in this country. But I want to talk about, the public sector, because the last 2 years have been tumultuous for Malaysia. We had COVID-19, we had two changes in government, three prime ministers. But through it all, many critical government functions like healthcare, judiciary continued. So kudos to them. But if anything, it emphasizes the importance of the role they play, since governments can literally change overnight. So how do we empower the civil service to operate without fear and favour to implement policy? Because let's be honest, Dato Sri, after GE15, you might not be occupying this ministerial post, or there might be even a change of government before the end of 12MP.
Civil servants play an important role in Malaysia's development. In the 60s, 70s, we know what civil servants did to transform the Malaysian economy.
Yes.
from a culture-based country to one which is one of the most diversified economies in the world. We have a good civil service. Of course, I'm not saying that it's perfect, but they are neutral by and large. There's some complaints here and there. But the pandemic is a case in point where they perform exceedingly well. The hospital services, the healthcare services, the security people and the CSOs have played a very, very important role. So civil servants have been the bedrock of Malaysia's stability. They provide the stability. We come and go. We politicians come and go. And we have to do a lot more to ensure that we enhance the professionalism of the civil service.
Does this also then mean that you're going to hasten the Public Service Act?
We have one of the game changers towards the end of the 12th Ministerial Plan. At the end doesn't mean it is of lesser importance. The civil servants, maybe I started life as a civil servant. I know the important role civil servants play. So we have to reform the civil service as well, make it more efficient, more meritocratic, less bureaucracy. We have decided that we should rationalize a few departments. There's a lot of duplication. In some cases, we've been working in silos. We got to be open and transparent.
Okay.
I think the public is getting more and more demanding,
Dato Sri.
Yeah, and we got to meet those aspirations to survive. For any government to survive, you got to meet people's aspirations.
Yeah, and you mentioned merit. So will this concept of meritocracy also evolve or also be important in GLC statutory bodies? Because the last few years, and I think all political parties are guilty of this, we have seen political appointments in board of directors, in CEOs. Is that going to change, though? Because we want the best people for those jobs.
Meritocracy has been there, to be fair, but we acknowledge that sometimes there are issues and challenges. And you got to be realistic in this current scenario where the current government, depends quite a bit on support from the opposition. The MOU signed on 13 September was a real milestone in the country's development. So we need to talk a lot more to each other. We need to improve, weaknesses here and there. This is so important. To advance as a country in terms of integrity, in terms of governance, we got to make improvements all around. Otherwise, we cannot be a high-income nation.
Yeah, but just this weekend, we have seen some political appointments to statutory bodies and GLCs. Will they all change, though, Dato Sri? Because governments have to walk the talk in terms of meritocracy.
Well, we've been saying that, a politician doesn't mean they don't have the technical expertise. Yeah, so, there's some politicians who are equally good at corporate work, for example. So you be aware that some politicians have done extremely well in some places.
Will they be removed?
Having said that, of course, there's room for improvement.
Yeah.
Room for improvement. We have to make improvements going forward.
Okay, and Dato Sri, I'm going to ask you a few questions about yourself. One of which is, are you going to be still running at the next general election for Jeli again?
Well, I've been around for quite some time. I've been serving my people to the best of my ability. We normally don't make announcements too soon. It's a long way to go. We believe there's many more months before we have to make that decision. So nearer election time, of course, we have to make a decision. But for the moment, I'll do my work to the best of my ability, serving my constituents and the country, national service. I've enjoyed my work, and I'll continue to do the best I can to serve this current government.
And do you think this theme of this Kelagua Malaysia will really make a difference this time, Dato Sri? You've been involved in two other Malaysian plans. This is the third one. Will it really be the game changer?
I was involved in the ninth Malaysia plan directly as minister. I was in the same position in 2004, many, many years ago. I can see, well, one is so complicated. There was no social media. Yeah, public wasn't as demanding. Yeah, we were not working 24/7. Now you got to be awake in the middle of the morning. So the landscape has changed a lot, and we have to be nimble. We got to be on our toes. Yeah, we got to listen to feedback, and we got to be quick. We got response time. We got to improve. So it's a totally different world altogether. And we have, as a nation, we have to do a lot better in terms of, you know, fine-tuning our policies, making sure the implementation is tip-top. Yeah? It is so important because the public is watching us 24/7, and the Prime Minister said that, you know, his assessment of us ministers will also depend on what the social media says about our performance. So, which is good, of course. As a country, we want the best from everyone, from ministers, from civil servants. I hope the Keluarga Malaysia concept will bring us together, will reduce the heat, the political temperature, and forces to focus on more constructive things.
On that note, thank you for your time today to discuss the many facets of the 12 Malaysia plan. Was Datuk Sri Mustafa Mohamad, Economics Minister in the Prime Minister's Department. I'm Wong Shan Ling, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.